I'm Caitlin Baggett Davis, and this is, by the way, Conversations with Portland. This is a new venture, and I'm so grateful to X-Ray FM for teaming up with me to make it possible. Let's start with an overview of what this next hour of conversation will pursue and why. I've been thinking lately about what it means to build something for a city. Not a building or a bridge exactly, although I am interested in physical spaces, but what it means to build a culture or a civic identity. What it means to build and sustain a democracy, if we're going to be real about it. It requires a special mix of leaders, movements, and institutions, and we're using this conversation to focus on the leaders who make Portland, Portland. I want to be clear from the outset that there is no intention here to expose information or break news. Although our conversation will include people in positions of power in Portland, it's not fundamentally a project with a theory about power or an interest in the mechanisms of power. I'm interested in people. I'm interested in the generosity, creativity, quirks, and bold visions of the people in our particular place, in this particular moment, who find themselves in positions from which they can serve the city, the region, or the world. Our conversations in this series will move through three rough acts: a personal introduction, a lighthearted exploration of something in the local news that is really not my guest's job, and finally, my guest's current work and goals. And my hope is that these conversations stray far from a resume, a pitch, or a stump speech, that we get to do the rare and human things: play, delve, go deeper, go the long way, and by the way, celebrate the complex humanity of the people we meet. My guest today has been a farm worker attorney with the California Agricultural Relations Board, the head of one of the world's most recognizable environmental organizations, Greenpeace, a strategist for the American labor movement, a college professor, and the founder of a political party. Barbara Dudley came to Portland in 1999 and has been here ever since, teaching at PSU, co-founding the Oregon Working Families Party, serving on boards, writing, advocating, and still asking, what else needs doing? Barbara, the Working Families Party recently hosted a big celebration to recognize your 80th birthday. Let's start there. What does turning 80 mean to you?
That we had the opportunity to raise some money for the Working Families Party. it's true. We founded the party on my 60th birthday. We started collecting signatures to make it an official party in the state of Oregon at the party, right? Mm-hmm. We had a nice dance party when I turned 60. So we've been doing them every 5 years since. And it's a good fundraiser, and 80 seemed like a good opportunity. Other than that, I can't say that it was particular. Oh, I'll tell you something interesting, though. This was not on my 80th, but a few weeks later, I woke up one morning and I realized that at 80 years old, I've lived a third of the life of this country.
What does that mean to you?
That means that this country is really bloody young, and it means that a lot has changed in my lifetime and in the 100 years before that, 80 years before that, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that huge changes have happened, and it means that huge changes can happen in the next 80 years. So it's given me a great way to talk to young people about not despairing about how miserable things are right now, because so much can happen in a lifetime.
We're going to get to your relationship with young people. You put young people at the center of your life. I want to talk a little bit about you as a young person.
Okay.
Your movement building career and life, and I get the sense that those two things are hard to separate, started in your youth in the 1960s and 1970s at Stanford and then at Berkeley Law. You came of age at a really particular moment in American history. We are in a very particular moment in U.S. history again right now. When you look back to the 60s and 70s, are there things about that period that feel like they matter more now, given where we are now?
I think we learned a lot about movement building. Uh-huh. It was before the days of the nonprofit sector. Uh-huh. People did not expect to be employed in their movement work. But many of us were employed in decent paying jobs, and the cost of living was next to nothing. I mean, I remember sort of calculating rent as $100 a month. Mm-hmm. And my law school tuition was $500 a semester, which is something that I torture young people with these days, because student debt was not an issue. Yeah. I mean, we could pay for our tuition with work study, which is what I did. I came out of school with absolutely no debt. Mm-hmm. And as a result, when I graduated from law school, I was able to go over to Southeast Asia. It was the middle of the Vietnam War, and with the Lawyers Guild, the National Lawyers Guild, and be an attorney for GIs who were resisting the war. I mean, I couldn't have done that if I had to get a job that paid my student debt. It would be impossible. So, you know, I think one of the first things that has to happen is we have to have a debt strike. We have to have a rebellion against the whole concept of student debt, because it hamstrings the next generation from doing anything with their lives other than desperately trying to earn enough money to pay off debt, never mind live in an apartment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can tell already in this conversation that every question is going to end in a political policy.
Yes, that's who I am.
When did you become that way?
Oh, I don't know. Probably in high school.
Why?
I would say. Well, because I had really good teachers. Mm-hmm. And it was a period of time. I mean, I remember learning about HUAC in a high school.
What's HUAC?
HUAC.
For our audience.
House Un-American Activities Committee. It was the U.S. House of Representatives version of the McCarthy crap that was going on. I had a professor who I guarantee you was blacklisted by McCarthy because, I mean, this was in high school. Because he had a doctorate. He was Dr. Peebles, and he was teaching in high school. So why was that? You know, probably because he was blacklisted. And the high school was smart enough to hire someone who obviously had good credentials. Anyhow, I learned about what was going on in the world. And, you know, I had a lot of opportunities. And then when I got, I mean, my freshman year in college was when JFK was killed. Mm-hmm. I mean, that happened a month after I started college. Kind of got your attention.
These are galvanizing moments.
Yes. And we became very aware of the beginnings of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. I mean, even in the, you know, mid-60s. And there was, I mean, it was a disgusting war. It was a stupid-ass war. And our generation had grown up with our fathers, mostly, and in some cases mothers, but mostly fathers being engaged in World War II. Which everybody talked about as this honorable thing to do, right? Mm-hmm. Fighting fascism out there in the world. Well, by my generation, what are we doing? You know, we're sort of becoming the new imperialists, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, as the French and the English withdrew from their colonies, we just said, oh, well, we'll take care of it, mm-hmm. you know? And then we made up communism as a great boogeyman, as we've revived today, you might have noticed.
Indeed. And is your high school curriculum gave you insight into that colonial position and how the United States was engaging worldwide? Or was that information and that education coming from outside of your school?
Some was in high school, a lot was in college, and it was definitely in the curriculum.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the era of the non-aligned movement. It was a very exciting moment in world history. And, you know, that I happened to be very interested in politics. And I majored in political theory, which became political science later. They kind of pretended it was a science, but in fact, as we've noticed, it's not a science at all.
maybe so. What did your parents do when you were growing up?
My dad worked for Northwest Airlines, so I spent my elementary school years in the Philippines and then junior high years in Hawaii, well, up until seventh grade. And then we moved to Connecticut. My mom wanted us to come back to the mainland, and because Hawaii wasn't even a state yet.
Oh, that's remarkable. Okay.
I know. There was one hotel on Maui, one hotel on Kauai, maybe three hotels on Oahu.
Wow.
A different period of time. But anyhow, so we came back to the States, and it was there that I went to high school.
Yeah. And for you growing up, it was your parents and you and your sister?
Yeah.
And how did your family respond to your interest in politics, your throwing yourself into a political life?
I don't know. They were always supportive.
Yeah.
I mean, my mother, I'm sure, worried. I mean, when I went back to the Philippines, you know, in the 70s to do the work with GIs during the war, I'm sure she was a little nervous about it, but they were always supportive.
Yeah. In the last 50 plus years of putting politics at the center of your life in this way and movement building, have you had doubts? Have you had moments of, why am I doing this? Or not at all for the radio?
No, I've had doubts about where the hell the world's going and where this country's going, yes. Uh-huh. But
doubts about the strategies of the movement building work?
Oh, always.
Yeah.
You know, are we doing the right thing? Should we be doing something else? How should we be doing it? Yeah, lots of that.
Yeah.
But not doubt about being engaged politically, no.
I want to go back to the starting question for of this moment in the 1960s and 70s compared to this moment now. You talked a little bit about the real differences in the economy between then and now and what that meant, particularly for young people getting involved in movement work. And you talked a little bit about the way that this work is structured. Is it a job? Is it something that's happening after work? Are there other similarities or differences that stand out for you between these two eras?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the differences in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, 60s, 70s, we'll talk about the 80s later, we had a liberal government. We had a liberal Supreme Court. I mean, liberal, capital L, liberal. Mm-hmm. And that's true of the Republicans even more than the Democrats, frankly, at that point in time, because we had the Southern Democrats who were hardly what you would call liberal.
Yes.
But the dominant thing that we were fighting against, the people against whom we were resisting, mm-hmm. were liberals.
Say more about that.
Well, I mean, when you think of, I mean, even Richard Nixon, for Pete's sake, you know, I mean, he's the guy who signed all of the environmental laws we take for granted now, mm-hmm. right? I mean, he was more liberal than any president we've had since in that sense of the word. Mm-hmm. He was a fool and a crook, but the overall political gestalt of the time was liberal, and the Supreme Court was liberal. So we took for granted that there was going to be a liberal government. And we were trying to get them to stop being also the imperialists that were, you know, being so aggressive around the world and thinking that, you know, it was their job to stop anybody who wanted a socialist government, mm-hmm. or even a non-aligned government. Mm-hmm. That's very different from today. Mm-hmm. I mean, today's become exceedingly dangerous. Yeah. I mean, starting with the first Trump administration, but even before that, you know, they're willing to go to lengths that nobody has ever gone before in this country.
You use the word dangerous. Dangerous for who?
Well, potentially for us. Mm-hmm. I mean, it depends on how far they're going to go. Certainly, you know, the organizations that I've been involved with historically, I mean, like the National Lawyers Guild, mm-hmm. is a left-wing mm-hmm. Legal organization that represents the people who are being assaulted in some way or another legally by the state. Well, now the Lawyers Guild itself is being threatened, you know? I mean, the Trump administration is busy calling everyone a domestic terrorist now, you might have noticed.
Yes.
And they're willing to put people in jail and able to put people in jail for 100 years, you know? I mean, they're not fooling around. This is where it's a very sudden transition.
I didn't ask dangerous for who out of some sense that things are somehow not dangerous. It seems dangerous for many communities, but I was curious if you felt personally or for other movement leaders that this is a dangerous movement for you.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I'm pretty safe, mostly because I'm a little old lady now. And I think it would be hard for the administration to put a little old lady on trial, but not impossible. I mean, I do have an FBI record. I know that for a fact, actually. It's not even theoretical, because when I was president of the Guild and executive director as well, back in the, 80s, we were suing the Department of Justice for the fact that they kept this, the Attorney General's list of subversive organizations.
Yeah.
And they tried to put us on that list. And so we sued them and said, excuse us, but what's the definition and who gave you the right to do this, right? And as a result, in discovery, we got boxes and boxes and boxes full of files. One of the files, of course, was about, I was in it, and it was about our time in Southeast Asia when we were defending GIs over there. And what they had in those files was copies of personal letters I had written to my mother.
What did that feel like?
It was such an offense. It was such an assault personally, you know? But it also made me realize how they operate. I mean, they're just like shameless.
How do you think they got those letters?
Oh, I know how they got them. They opened up our mail and copied them and then closed the mail up and sent the letter off to my mom.
I'm curious. I've known you now for a little more than a decade, maybe 15 years. I've always known you to be somebody who stays out of the limelight. And I'm wondering if that's been on purpose, if this sense of danger and wanting to be in the background or working on strategy and advising, is it this moment in your life that I've gotten to know you, or has that been your approach throughout your life?
I'm better there.
Hmm.
I mean, I've never run. Well, that's not true. I did run for office once. long
Thank
long
you.
But mostly, I like strategizing.
Let's talk about young people. You love working with young people.
I do.
Is this part of this chapter in your life, or has engaging young people been a part of your work from the very beginning?
I mean, I was a young person for
yeah.
a while. No, one of the things I did when I got back from Southeast Asia, I worked with older women. Mm-hmm. I worked with a group called Jobs for Older Women, and then it became the Displaced Homemakers Network, and I loved that. I mean, I like intergenerational conversation is what I like. I think we have a lot to learn from each other. I mean, it was one of the reasons I really appreciated being part of the National Lawyers Guild, is because I learned so much from my elders. I mean, the Guild was formed in 1937, so it was that generation, and I learned a ton from them. And when I became president of the Guild, I made sure to get at least one of the more prominent elders who'd been the executive secretary during the McCarthy era to be on our National Executive Committee, just because I learned so much from him and I wanted him to be part of the conversation. And I think now that I'm an elder, I think that's as important going in the other direction. I think we have a whole lot to learn from each other.
Over the last, let's say, 30 years, how has your sense of the quality of discourse across the generations changed? I imagine that what we have to learn from each other might be constant, but I'm wondering, I'll say this. It feels in the last 10 years that there's become a deeper generational divide in our politics. And I'm wondering if that holds for you over the last 30 or 40 years, or you think, nope, there's always been a generational divide.
Sure there has.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I remember the divisions between the old left of, you know, of the 30s and 40s and the new left of my generation, right? I mean, oh my God, we drove them crazy.
Over what kinds of things?
Oh, dear God in heaven. I mean, one of the things that comes to mind immediately is making them eat granola at the convention in 1971. One of my favorite old commies. Was like, really, do I have to eat this bloody stuff? But no, I mean, in terms of substance, it was much more they came out of the McCarthy era, which was more like today than the era we were in. Remember how I was talking about the, you know, liberals were in charge when we were causing havoc in the 60s? they did not have liberals in charge, right? They had McCarthy and Brownell, and I mean, they'd been through hell.
Yes.
And so they were more cautious in a way, but also more intent on insisting on a role for the left in the national conversation. Mm-hmm. And we didn't give a damn about that. We were just...
What do you mean by a role for the left in the national conversation? Do you mean that they were interested in gaining platforms? Or...
They were interested in undoing the concept of un-Americanism. I mean, the fact that leftists were called un-American, what the hell does that mean? I mean, we're the only country that talks like that, right? That a political theory is un-French or un-English or un-Nigerian or, I mean, that's not how people talk about it. There's a range of political opinions in a country. And to say that you're therefore not part of this country because of your political opinion, that was unheard of. Mm-hmm. And that was what they were fighting about. Mm-hmm. And today we're back to that.
Yeah, we are. But you were describing a dynamic where the older generation was more conservative and potentially more institutionally focused?
Not more conservative. Their politics were certainly as far left as
more
ours.
More cautious.
No, more insistent on being part of the national dialogue, part of the political dialogue. Not cautious. Mm. Insisting on being overtly part of the dialogue and not being marginalized.
And your generation at that time wasn't concerned about being marginalized. You were looking for the places where new ideas could gain traction.
And we could push people through action. Yeah. I mean, draft resistors were draft resistors, mm-hmm. right? I mean, as they were during World War I as well, actually. I mean, there's a whole history to be discussed here that we don't have time for.
Next podcast.
Right. But that's why I love intergenerational conversations, is I learned that history from people who had lived it.
Yeah.
And it made a huge difference. And today, even, it makes a huge difference to me because it helps me cope with the current reality. Not necessarily cope with, because I don't feel like I'm coping very well, but it helps me understand it, put it in context.
And could you characterize the relationship between your generation and the younger generation now in terms of the different approach to politics?
I think it depends on who we're talking about. I mean, I don't think my generation is monolithic. You know, I mean, I have all kinds of people who, you know, are kind of less politically engaged than I am, who'll call me up and say, can you explain DSA? I don't get what they want. And, you know, well, I can explain it to the extent that I talk to them, yes. Yeah. And you could talk to them too, you know? I mean, there's a great way to find out what people are all about. It's talk to them.
Yes. You know, I believe in that one.
Right, exactly. So I think the divide, it depends on who we're talking about.
I want to get back to the generational topic, but it is time for our mid-program detour, Not My Circus. This is the part of the show where I ask a highly talented community leader to help solve a problem that is really not their job. My guest today is Barbara Dudley, and she serves on the boards of the Working Families Party and the Sunrise Movement, and has been leading strategic progressive movement work in many arenas for more than 50 years. Like most talented people I know, your network is your secret weapon. So you can call a friend to help with this question. Do you have someone ready to take your call?
Yeah, but we don't know yet what the question is.
I know. I'll introduce the question when they join.
Hello?
Okay, here we go.
Okay.
You're on the radio, girl, and I have no flipping idea what the question's going to be. This is my friend Barbara Bird. Right.
Barbara Bird, welcome to, by the way, Conversations with Portland. Barbara, could you introduce yourself briefly before we dive in on this question? Thank you for joining.
Oh, of course. My pleasure. So my name is Barbara Bird. I am retired from teaching at the University of Oregon at the Labor Education and Research Center for about 23 or 4 years. And for the last 14 years or so of that time, I also served as Secretary Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO.
Great. The two of you are going to be so good at answering this question. Okay. Here's my setup. Third space is a concept of a place that is neither home nor work. A third space where people gather, share ideas, connect, and form community. Through human history, and long before the coinage of third space, which I think is a Starbucks coinage, bars have been third spaces. But since the pandemic, I've noticed something weird happening at bars. And I want to know how the two of you would go about fixing it, whether that's through policy, a public education campaign, or some other approach. Okay, here's the thing. People are making reservations for bar seats. You arrive,
such a thing.
You arrive at the bar and there's a little reserved plaque on the bar. And they're arriving as a couple or a single person and they're ordering dinner as though they're at the other tables in the restaurant. And so third places, these bars that used to be informal, gregarious, and full of random connections have become formal and orderly. What should we do?
Go to a different bar. I'm right? I mean, you're describing certain kinds of fancy bars, but man, there are plenty of bars I go to that don't have any such thing.
That sounds way too cumbersome. I mean, and no fun to have to go through all of that.
So you're suggesting a boycott.
No, I'm just suggesting an alternative.
So why, Caitlin, tell us something. Why do people do that? Why do they go to particular bars? Is there something about those particular bars that draws them in, or what's the deal?
You know, it's a really good question, Barbara, and I don't know the answer, but I can say that since the pandemic, I and other people who I spend time with in the community have noticed this trend. And I'm just, you know, wondering, do we need a PSA? Do we need incentives and policies to encourage more gregarious and informal socializing? If this was your job to fix this problem, how would you go about it? Barbara is giving me the most incredulous look.
I mean, I think it's just a symptom of people having too bloody much money. And they think going to a bar is like going out to a fancy dinner. I mean, call me.
I get why they want to go to bars. Because it's easier than having everybody come over to your house and you have to cook and all that stuff. I mean, I get it. I get that it would be convenient. And I agree it's probably people with more money that they quite know what to do with. But it does seem... It just seems odd. Why wouldn't they just, if they want to go someplace and have space enough for all of them, just like make a reservation for everybody and say, we want that table over in the corner, and then just go and sit there. I mean, it just doesn't, it seems so weird.
I love, you don't have a class analysis necessarily. You just have the level of class outrage about the question itself. And I appreciate that.
No, it's not outrage. It's disbelief. I wouldn't call that a bar. I'd call that a restaurant.
Exactly.
But they're bars.
So, Caitlin, how many people come to these events? What are we talking about here?
Well, Barbara, I'm not talking about events. I'm saying my husband and I go to a bar and a restaurant to sit down and get a drink, and we think that we should be able to just walk in and stand at the bar like we did in 2018. But the bar seats are reserved, and there is no – the culture has shifted – that there isn't a sense that you can just go and have an informal experience.
Seriously, go patronize a different bar. I mean, the bars will learn their lesson that way.
So it's a boycott is your strategy. Isn't that a boycott?
I suppose, but I don't even think of it that way. I mean, I just think of it as a choice.
All right.
I guess I misunderstood the scenario here. So it's just you and your husband, and you end up talking to whoever you're sitting next to? Is that the deal?
That used to be the case.
Used to be.
That used to be. So the great thing about a bar used to be that you would go in, and it was very informal, and people might gather around the bar. You would meet people you'd never talked to before. You would talk to people who had different political views. But now it has become very orderly, and there's a sense of, you know, I'm in my space, you're in your space, I've got my reservation, and it seems less community oriented.
Barbara, you can tell them. You can tell them about what happens when we go to bars.
What happens when you go to bars?
Let me just say, Barbara Dudley loves to talk to strangers. And it doesn't matter where we are, which bar, where we're sitting at the bar or at tables or whatever, she will immediately strike up a conversation with whatever stranger is sitting close to us.
It sounds like you might have some good stories out of these interactions.
Of course.
Of course. Can you tell a story?
You know, but I did, and I haven't experienced what you're talking about, Kevin, but my daughter, who just came up here from Mexico City, she lived down there a long time, can't get over the fact that people line up at the bar to get a drink. Like there's these orderly lines of people waiting to order from the bartender, which she thinks is the most bizarre thing she ever saw. So I don't know.
Okay. Barbara Bird, thank you so much for calling in for our silly detour.
I'm so glad we could solve your problem for you.
I'll take you guys out with me for a drink.
For a drink. Okay.
There you go. That's
right. Exactly.
Thank you both. Hang it up now.
All right. Have a great Zoom, girl.
You work closely with Maurice Mitchell and the team at the Working Families Party nationally. You're on the board.
I'm now no longer on the national executive board. I'm still on the national committee.
Okay.
But I kind of aged out of the national executive board, but yes.
I want to hear about aging out, but that's fine. during the pandemic, 4 years ago, Maurice published a widely shared overview of the cultural and structural challenges facing movement building organizations right now. And before our detour, we were talking about generational differences. Let's talk about what's happening with movement organizations, how that work has evolved, and some of the challenges that they're facing right now. How are you thinking about it today, maybe as compared to 4 years ago?
Well, I would go back further than 4 years. I mean, I think I said this earlier in our conversation, one of the big shifts has been to sort of evolve into the nonprofit industrial complex, as we say.
I do hear that term, but what does that term mean to you?
What that means to me is that organizations that think of themselves as part of a movement or as the movement in some cases are dependent on funders. And who those funders are and what those funders want politically in the world is dominant, because they won't fund you if they don't like what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And that skews, because also there's usually a generational distinction between the funders and the doers, mm-hmm. right? And so it's makes it difficult, I think, for the people in the organization to be making totally independent decisions. They're often very cautious. And I know right now, a lot of organizations are feeling very cautious about the potential of losing their 501c3 status mm-hmm. or their 501c4 status, because the Trump administration is like throwing threats around like, you know, candy right now. Yeah. And people think of that as an existential threat. Yeah. You know, we lose our C3 and we're toast. Yeah. And that's problematic.
Yeah, that view is problematic.
The view is problematic, but also it goes back to the thing about young people not being financially independent.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, those things are very tied together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you wanted me to go into my rant about the Reagan administration, I would do that for you, you know.
About the time?
About how we got there, you know, where mm-hmm. he eliminated public funding for, you know, higher education mm-hmm. very deliberately mm-hmm. to put people into debt so that they wouldn't be out on the streets protesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, he said that.
Yeah.
So there was that. And then he lowered the marginal tax rate down to 28% from 70% under mm-hmm. John Kennedy. And as a result, we had all these private foundations mm-hmm. that are now running our political system. Mm-hmm. A few of them on the left, mm-hmm. the vast majority of them on the right. Mm-hmm. Right. And they're now funding people directly to run for office, but they're also funding all the nonprofits. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about generational differences in movement leadership and movement work. And I think one of the things that I'm curious about in this moment of increasing sense of urgency and need for effective and strategic movement work, how this generation is showing up in that work really matters. And it feels like it's pulling in many different directions. You're spending a lot of time working with, coaching, supporting young leaders. What's coming up in those conversations?
Well, it varies from organization to organization. I would say that the Working Families Party is very electorally focused. And even there, it varies from state to state. I mean, they're active now in 20 some states, you know, and depending on the politics of that state, how the Working Families Party is engaged varies dramatically. The Lawyers Guild is up to its eyebrows in immigration defense and activist defense. I don't know. I think I'm losing your question. The Sunrise Movement folks have kind of steered away some from their major focus, which is climate change, to now sort of an anti-authoritarianism focus.
So here's where I think my question is coming from. When you were talking about movement building work in as you were engaged in your youth, you said you had the financial freedom for it not to be your job. And you've spent a little bit of time describing the emergence of the nonprofit industrial complex. And also recognizing that for this generation of movement leaders, they expect to be compensated for their work. I'm wondering if you see a tension with those expectations and effective strategy for change.
Well, yeah, but I don't know what the alternatives are.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why, I mean, not to ring my bell too many times, but that's why I really think, you know, number one focus has to be on student debt. And yeah. I think it would be a very bicameral fight. I mean, every young person is affected by it and they keep mucking around the edges, you know, with a little twist here and a little twist there. I can't make sense out of it. I mean, I went to bloody law school and I can't understand what they're talking about with the new rules on student debt and repayments and all that stuff. And each administration comes up with some new twist. So I think the young people don't have a lot of choice. I mean, A, there are not a lot of jobs out there for starters, and B, they want to be doing movement work. So, you know, yes, they need the job. And in many cases, yes, they'll even unionize, you know, to insist that they get some control over how long they're going to have the job and what they're going to get paid and what the conditions are going to be. I think to call that a movement is a little tricky. I mean, I used to, back when I was the head of Greenpeace, I mean, I would cringe at the concept of the environmental movement because there were so many different types of people fighting for so many different issues, and they were not necessarily fighting in the same way or, you know, towards the same ends in some instances. So even the labor movement is split, you know? I mean, movements, the word movement needs more definition. To have a serious conversation, I think.
What do you think is a better way of describing a directional push of aligned parties?
I don't know the answer.
You know, in the anti-authoritarianism moment that we're in, you know, Scott Nakagawa has been writing prolifically about what has worked globally to resist authoritarianism.
Yes.
And one of the concepts that is now in play is the idea of many springs leading to a river.
Yes.
Which I've found
I think it's
useful.
A very good, good metaphor.
I want to spend a little bit more time on this concept of being employed in mission work. Let's call it mission work instead of movement work. I was talking with my daughter, who's 19 and is, for the last couple of years, has been teaching and working with low-income and disadvantaged youth. And one of the things that she's really struggled with is the reality of low compensation in a field that matters a lot. And for her, she recognizes that she's choosing the work and that she also chose that compensation level when she chose the work. what she struggles with are colleagues who say, that's my 8 hours, I'm done. And she said to me the other day, my generation has it lacks clarity about the relationship between labor and compensation. If you are only willing to do work if you are compensated for it, you can never be part of a larger community. Which struck me as such an interesting way to think about labor and compensation in a mission field. Your contribution to community, if it only comes with compensation, is fundamentally challenging. Is this an area that you've thought about much?
Yeah, I'm not sure I've thought about it exactly in that way, but I've thought about it through different lenses at different times. The organizations that I worked for were quite different. I mean, back in the day, yeah, when I came back from Southeast Asia, I helped start an organization called the Berkeley Oakland Women's Union, mm-hmm, right, which was a socialist feminist organization. We worked our asses off, many ways forming theory more than doing anything, but you know, we worked. But nobody worked for BOWU. Oh. I mean, there was no, you know, we all had other sources, you know, we had jobs, yeah, right? And no debt.
Yes.
And $100 rent. So all of those things were true. You know, the same thing when I went to the Lawyers Guild is supported by its members. Mm-hmm. Many of whom are lawyers. They're also law students and legal workers, but so there's dues and you pay substantial dues. Mm-hmm. And that's what supports the organization. It has a small staff. It's mostly run by volunteers. Like the Portland chapter has no staff, you know. Yeah. People just do it in their spare time, of which there's very little these days because, yeah, you know, but they're all doing lots of volunteer work. I mean, they may have a paid job, they may be a public defender or whatever, but they're doing extra duty, you know, doing time over at the detention, the ICE facility, mm-hmm, here and stuff like that. You know, I mean, there's a lot of extra work to be done. And I don't know anyone in the Lawyers Guild who isn't working their ass off. But it's also an interesting perspective when you're 80 years old and, quote, retired, right?
It's a different perspective.
It's a very different perspective. I mean, I continue to do political work, but probably for fewer hours, mm-hmm, than, mm-hmm, you know, I used to, but yeah, I still am, you know, as engaged, and certainly nobody's paying me to do it. I certainly don't blame the young people. I think financially they're really in a very tough position, mm-hmm, and that leads to a sort of, you know, pay me or I'm not doing this kind of attitude, I think, in some cases. I think some of them do their movement work beyond that. I mean, certainly DSA, for example, is a very good example. It's a thriving organization that is having a huge impact politically right at this moment in time.
It sure is.
And they're not staffed. I mean, they may have one or two paid staff, but I don't even think they have that, mm-hmm, here. I mean, you know, so it's sort of back to the old vision of what a movement organization would be, mm-hmm, you know?
Largely volunteer-led. So I have a question about DSA that is maybe a generational question, but maybe a question about the duration of a person's engagement in the political world. As I look at the DSA nationally and particularly the incredible success that the DSA has seen in New York, and I look at DSA chapters in smaller places like Portland, I see a difference in political maturity in the strategies, the leadership development, and support for leaders. I'm not saying the maturity or immaturity of individuals. I'm talking about maturity of strategy and systems. I think that we see something like this playing out in Portland right now, that we have active and motivated DSA members in the community and the city council who are operating with less support and less depth of experience around policymaking, community engagement than what we're seeing in a place like New York. Does that, first, that's my analysis of what's happening. I'm curious about your response to that.
I don't really know the answer. My perception is that it's also a question of personalities. I mean, you're extrapolating a bit from Zoran Mamdani, who happens to be an extraordinary human being, as far as I'm concerned.
So far as I can
tell. The guy is one of the most articulate, charismatic people we've seen on the political scene from of any political stripe for a long, long time. He has done really well since he's been in office in terms of transparency and clarity. He has surrounded himself with really smart people, not all of whom by any means are DSAers. He really chose carefully. He has, you know, a kind of a cabinet of people who help make him what he is.
Yeah.
And he has the budget of the city of New York. The mayor here is not DSA. and so, you know, and you do not have a particular person here who is of the stature of Mamdani. There's not a leader, a visible leader, but Mamdani, I don't think, was either within DSA, right? That just happened to be an organization he affiliated with, but he was, you know, he's on his own path. So I don't know the answer in terms, I think that it's a personality driven thing. I think the fact that they were able to pass here, DSA was really the force behind passing the preschool for all legislation. I think that that was brilliantly done, you know? I mean, and now, you know, they need to deal with the attacks on it and all of that and deal with the need to do something statewide and blah, 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 all of that. But certainly strategically, they were able to handle that quite well.
Yeah.
And I'm looking and saying, you know, they've done a lot in terms of getting people elected. Whether they're able to help those people govern is another question. And I don't know what that interaction is.
I think that that's the basis of my question about maturity of structures and maturity of strategy is supporting governance. There's a different level of capacity and experience needed to win things at the ballot than to move things through a complex legislative process.
Exactly. And remember, Mamdani was in the state legislature, state assembly, before he became mayor. I mean, he had experience governing.
Yeah.
The folks who got elected to this new city council, with rare exceptions, and they're not the DSAers, had some, you know, had no experience. I mean, okay, I'm twisting my, you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
I mean, we have Novick and Dan Ryan and Loretta, you know, Smith, who had experience.
Yes.
The rest of them, none.
Or less.
Less. Yeah. Olivia had some.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the DSAers were not office holders before they were elected, unless I'm missing something.
They were not.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
So that's tricky in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. We're really seeing two levels of, you know, the term of art in Portland right now is learning curve, that there is a learning curve around the new form of government, and then there's a learning curve for every elected leader who is stepping into this role who's never been elected before.
Right. Well, and Keith Wilson being an example too.
I mean,
good heavens, right? I mean, to have a mayor with no political experience and an overwhelming majority on the city council with no political experience, I mean, you're bound to have chaos for the first term, it seems to me, and a new form of government that nobody really understands yet.
We have just a little while left, and I want to ask one more question in this vein of mission and movement work and many springs, and then we have our final question coming up. Over the last several years, there's been a renewed effort to do work in an area that people are now calling bridging, connecting communities across differences. In some ways, you might say that's not new work. That work is as old as the Bible, but we're calling it bridging now. I see a fundamental tension between bridging work and movement or base building work, that efforts to mobilize and energize groups of people around their differentiating agreements is in tension with efforts to bring people together across those differences. And we're trying to do both right now. And some might argue we really have to do both right now. But I'm wondering for you in your career and your work, if you found yourself more on one side or the other of this dynamic, and how you've navigated it.
My gut tells me that I was often in a position where I could do both. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that comes to mind, just because I brought it up earlier, so it was sort of sitting in the back of my head, was back in the day with the Berkeley Oakland Women's Union, a socialist feminist organization. And I also simultaneously got involved with Jobs for Older Women and the Displaced Homemakers Network. Very different politically in some ways, yeah, but not always. Mm-hmm. But I was in a position to sort of weave the two together in a very, for me, fulfilling way.
Yeah.
That I think was helpful to everybody to sort of expand their political philosophy as well as their strategies.
Go back for just a moment. In these different kinds of work with women, was weaving it together bringing them together?
In some cases, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And can you just talk a little bit about how that worked?
Well, I got some of the women from the Displaced Homemakers movement, mm-hmm, to come and meet with some of the BOWU women and talk.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how it works, is talking.
Talking. And were those conversations facilitated? Was it purely social with the hope that there was a...
It wasn't purely social, no. It was about issues.
Yeah.
Yeah. And facilitated, you know, in the sense that we got them together, yes.
Yeah. But beyond that, it wasn't mediated.
No. Because there wasn't tension to start with. There was just ignorance.
Yeah.
I mean, they were two entirely different generations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when I started at Greenpeace, we had just... So the first conference of environmental justice, people of color conference of environmental justice, I can't remember, I'm getting the title wrong, but there was a conference that happened in 92 that really brought the issue of environmental justice and communities of color and the environmental impacts on them, mm-hmm, to the fore. Mm-hmm. That was like a new conversation.
Yeah.
Right.
In 1992, it certainly
was.
Yes.
So that's when I became the head of Greenpeace. And part of my mandate was to bring that into reality. And so, you know, like changing the senior leadership and doing different kinds of campaigns and focusing more on toxics, mm-hmm, for example, than on whales and, you know, et cetera. And so, yeah, there was a lot of bridging that had to happen there, and not all of it was easy by any means, mm-hmm, but something that, you know, I really embraced as being essential and also being fascinating.
I think of you as operating and leading more on the left side of the political spectrum, further left, and being close friends and intellectual thought partners with people who situate themselves in the center and right of center. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I, as Barbara Bird said, I love talking to anybody.
Yeah.
And finding out, you know, who they are and how they think and why they think. I mean, my sense is that for the most, I mean, there are some terrible people in this world. One of them is running this country. But apart from a few real nitwits who I would not want to talk to, like Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump, you know, there are a lot of people I find really interesting to like find out how they think and why. Mm-hmm. And often there's common ground. Mm-hmm. I mean, most often. I rarely find, you know, like, I don't want to have anything to do with you, you know, as sort of my reaction to talking to somebody.
I think when I describe this tension between base building work or campaign strategy work and bridging work, one of the tensions is, well, what if part of the strategy is leaving the people we don't agree with in the dark or not letting them see or understand how we're thinking about things so that you can advance strategy. Does this kind of navigation of a world of strategic omissions or strategic silence come up? You're giving me the most puzzled look ever.
No. I think tactics maybe.
Yeah.
But strategy, no.
No, you want to have open, transparent exploratory conversations about strategy, even and especially with people who you disagree with.
Yeah.
Okay, this is our final question we're asking of every guest. I'm going to set it up for you. Since time immemorial, people in this place have stewarded the land we call home for future generations. 130 years ago, visionary civic leaders saw the great promise for this small town of about 17,000 people on the banks of the Willamette. And they preserved land and a lake that now provide fresh drinking water to nearly a million people. That drinking water is from the Bull Run Reservoir. My question for you is, what is your Bull Run? What is something small or big that you believe we can build today for future generations, whether that's for Portland or for the Pacific Northwest or something larger?
I don't see it as something we can build so much as something we can preserve. I worry deeply that we are destroying this planet, at least human life on this planet. I am of the opinion that Mother Nature bats last, and the planet and many of its non-human inhabitants will survive in one fashion or another. But we are so rapidly making this place uninhabitable. Data centers just being the latest version of that conversation. I mean, the thought that we would put AI into a category where it's more important than human life blows my mind. What I would stress is do everything we can to preserve the parts of this nature that we live in that make it possible for us to survive.
My guest today is Barbara Dudley. She's been leading different kinds of movement and mission work for more than 50 years, passionate about intergenerational dialogue and dialogue across difference. Thank you so much for being with us today, Barbara. It's been a pleasure.